Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Our reading this morning is from the book of Daniel, chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to sing, to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned to them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, to Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favour and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge, understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, the book of Daniel seems to be about a clash of kingdoms. In it, we see a picture of almost all of the large superpowers that went from the time of Babylon and up to the time of the end of the Greek kingdom, perhaps the start of Rome. We can see that it's not simply a clash of seen kingdoms, but of unseen kingdoms. So, of course, the people of Israel, brought out of slavery in Egypt, had developed into a nation that was strong, that had their own king. And King David and King Solomon were sort of the peak of this kingdom time for the people of Israel. And when they had that peak time, they knew that God, Yahweh God, was truly the strongest in the universe. They knew that the king of all creation, their king, was ruling and reigning. And then suddenly it all seemed to fall apart. The north and the south, of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, divided. The kings themselves, the leaders within the people of God, seemed to be fighting more than they were representing who God was to the world. And their new superpowers, Assyria and Egypt, came against Israel and then Judah. Israel, the northern kingdom, was really destroyed, taken into exile, really just totally absorbed into this kingdom of Assyria. And they found themselves in the south turning to Egypt. And you and I might go, you're kidding me. This is the superpower that held you captive. This is your enemy. And yet I guess when it comes to the crunch, you'll look anywhere. And God said to them, don't look to Egypt. Don't play these politics because you're not going to win. And in fact, there's another nation, another power, another kingdom coming. And in fact, it will be the one that destroys the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, and takes you off into exile. If you've read any of the larger prophets like Jeremiah or Ezekiel, this is the time about which they're speaking. And so it seems when we read the book of Daniel that we've kind of got a lovely fairy story. Once upon a time, there was a man called Daniel, and he went to Babylon, and he did really well. But actually, even in those first few lines, we're seeing great pain and destruction. When Babylon came against Jerusalem, yes, they took these brilliant young men, but they didn't just siege it once. Now, there were three sieges of Jerusalem as King Nebuchadnezzar and as Babylon as a whole attempted to bring Judah into their kingdom. And by the third siege, it was really just horrific. We've read, we can read in 2 Kings 24, but some of the pictures that you see in Jeremiah, parents having to do things that they never thought they'd have to do because they were in complete starvation. The way that prisoners of war were treated was nothing that we could imagine. You know, you would cut off tongues and ears, you would display generals to humiliate. This was a dreadful, dreadful time. And so we mustn't come to the book of Daniel thinking that it's a fairy story with some heroes. These heroes seem to have been caught up in this destruction, this downward spiral of Jerusalem because it hasn't been faithful to its God. And they have actually been deported. And it seems like the Babylonian God is suddenly stronger than Israel's God. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So much pain in one verse. And then the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. I don't know if you remember the stories in the earlier parts of Israel's history when they had the Ark of the Covenant. And when it got stolen, the Ark of the Covenant, which was this to be in the tabernacle and then the temple, which was a box that kind of God's presence was over, and it represented God being with them. When it got stolen by the Philistines, things tended to go really badly for those who stole it. And in the end, they give it back because they're like, we don't want this. This is bad news for us. At one point, they put it in their temple, the temple of a god called Dagon. And every morning when they go in there, the statue of Dagon has fallen before the Ark of the Covenant. It's just this fantastic story. I love it. When Phil and I went on our honeymoon, we stayed in Port Douglas in this kind of Bali-style hotel, and they had little Buddha statues everywhere, and we just did a Dagon just for kind of, I don't know, it was our thing. Anyway. But here, okay, not in the foyer. For those watching online, he said not in the foyer. We didn't do like a whole, you know, but here, the temple vessels, the beautiful things from the temple of God have been captured and taken into the temple of the god of Babylon. And it's actually really interesting because it says Babylonia here, not Babylon. And that's because it has the Hebrew for the plain of Shinar, which is this old way of referring to Babylon. But the first time that we see this reference to the plain of Shinar is when the Tower of Babel is being built. That's where it was. And this is Babylon and the Tower of Babel, which at the end of that kind of primeval history in Genesis 1 to 11, this is the pinnacle of people's rebellion against God, the power against God, the unholy kingdom. And here it is again. We thought God had defeated this, and now the temple vessels are basically back at the Tower of Babel. What is God doing? How could he submit to this humiliation? This is what it is. But we've seen these very confusing words, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. God did this? God allowed this? Something happening between kingdoms on the surface, but then unseen. God's hand is allowing this humiliation of God's self. Not only, of course, the humiliation to God of the temple vessels, but this strategic deportation of the best and the brightest, the royals, those that were related to King David, those that possibly were being trained for the priesthood, because this is what you wanted to do if you were a king coming against a new nation. You didn't just want to have land. You actually wanted to have more resources and the best and the brightest human resources. And so they have this list, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. And given that I'm thinking about my honeymoon, that really was my list. that I was looking for, and I ticked them all off. So the best and the brightest, deported and re-educated. Now, once again, we mustn't think of this as a fairy story. To be re-educated into another's culture was to have your culture, your identity stripped. Everything that could make you who you were was to be taken from you. Your language, your history, your name. When we see the names of Daniel, I'm going to get there. It's going to be like that the whole time because it's my pretend Hebrew way of saying it. It's probably wrong. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You've got some endings there that are talk about God, the Hebrew God. You have El for Elohim, and you have Yah, I-A-H, for Yahweh. All four of these names are God names. Daniel is God is my judge. And so to take these men and to change their names from their God names to these names, Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which have the names of Babylonian gods. Bel was a goddess. Nego is the same as Nebo, Nebuchadnezzar, Nabonidus, the Babylonian god. To take your god names and give you a new god name. Everything about this seems to be to destroy their religion, their culture, and to bring them to loyalty to the new state. Now, actually, this still happens around the world today. People are being re-educated from their religions in large superpowers and in small ways, of course. And so we wonder to ourselves when this does happen, and when we find ourselves in a kingdom that seems to be trying to erode our identity, what do we do? Especially when we seem powerless or it's not possible to live in that place without compromising or without having something taken from us, what do we do? Are we defiled? Can we be holy in an unholy kingdom? Well, this is Daniel's question in chapter 1. And he's asking this, what do I do to be holy rather than defiled, polluted, changed beyond recognition? And so it says, Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now, when it comes to food, we know that the Jewish people, that was one of their distinctivenesses. They knew that what you ate stood you apart. And it was actually a really powerful way of keeping a community together. And so when we look at this choice of Daniel's to not eat from the king's table, but to only have vegetables and water, it can seem like it's obedience to the Levitical laws. So we don't know what the meat is that they're being served. We don't know whether it's kept separate from the dairy. We don't know whether it's been killed in the right way. It's not kosher. But it may be that it's more than that. Because actually you could have wine, that was not an unclean thing. There would have been certain things that you could have that didn't just mean it had to be vegetables. There's probably more going on. looking not backwards then, but forwards to kind of a second century BC and then Jesus' time when the book of Daniel was in really, really big prominence. It may have been understood that Daniel was saying, I will not eat Gentile food. So you know, if you've read much of the New Testament, that that Jewish people did not eat meals with Gentiles. And it wasn't just a, well, what if they kept things kosher? You know, can we provide you with a vegetarian meal and we'll eat together? No, you didn't eat together. It didn't matter what. And so that's why it was such a big deal when Peter went for fellowship at Cornelius's house and he'd had that dream of the unclean foods, why people were so shocked at what Jesus did and having table fellowship with sinners. So this could be about this distinctiveness. I don't eat Gentile food no matter what it is. But the vegetables are still coming from the same place. It's possible that the vegetables too may have been offered to a Babylonian deity. Perhaps there's even more. I suspect that Daniel and his friends were also saying, we can't partake of the richness of your table when we know that much of your riches have come from the destruction of our land. And this is like sackcloth and ashes for food. We'll only eat vegetables and water because we mourn what has been taken from our nation. In Ezekiel chapter 4, he is told that he can only eat while he's in mourning for his nation this special bread made of legumes and kind of, it's soup. You can actually buy it. Has anyone seen Ezekiel bread in the shops? And it's kind of this sprouted seeds and legume thing. And here the language is a little bit like that. It could be talking about legumes as well as veggies, right? And so that's the food, that's the bread of mourning. So it could be we're mourning what has happened to our nation. But again, there's probably more. When you get taken out for dinner by someone, there's a sense of a bond being formed. When you invite someone to your home to share a meal, then suddenly maybe, you know, that person, oh, we'll have you over next time. When you get taken out by a business associate or a salesperson, then that bond kind of starts to come with a whole bunch of obligation in the background. When I was a medical student, the pharmaceutical companies would offer amazing, I was keen as mustard. Like, I was like, take me down to the Cumberland in Lawn, I'm ready. And even as a, you know, first year, second year, I'm like, a free pen, wow. But of course, you know, this comes with I know this brand, I have a loyalty to you, you have taken me to this place, okay. There is an allegiance here. And I think that what we're seeing is a refusal to engage in that loyalty to the king through sharing in his table. So they did not want to say, yes, our provision comes from you. Yes, we are bonded to you. Yes, we are part of this. And I think it's actually a position of integrity. Because they could have, and then just secretly, you know, said, well, we're going to be against, you know, you anyway. But that was a really delicious lamb roast, thank you. But the integrity is, if we had shared this meal with you, and yet our God and our religion and our culture requires us to take a stand against you in the future, we've actually done wrong by you, particularly in this culture. We've taken your food and now we've stood against you. As people of integrity, we can't do that. So really all of these things add up, I think, to a holy rebellion. that they are taking the thing that they can control, what they do with their body. They can't control what they call them, their names. They can't control where they've placed them. They can't run away. But they can control what they eat. And this is their moment of rebellion. But it's not a rebellion at the cost of another. And I think that is absolutely fascinating. I don't want to extrapolate too much. But their expectation that even if they are tested, things will go well for the guard is really quite striking. That it's okay, we will choose this thing and we expect that God will bring good out of it for us and for you. So there is both expectation and compassion in their choice. And I think all of these things are part of what it means to live holy in an unholy kingdom. You and I will be faced with this in different ways really every day. And there may not be the same or the one response required of each of us, but this will be required. There will be obedience required. There will be distinctiveness. There will be mourning. I cannot celebrate all that this culture celebrates. There will be loyalty and Daniel's name, God is my judge. But there will be integrity in the midst of that. I'm not to say, it's okay, I'll enjoy, but then I'll also stand against. How? There will be rebellion. There will be an expectation that God is with us, and there will be a compassion for the good of others. Now, Daniel does this, and it appears that he is rewarded because he starts to look like the opposite of what the unfaithful, unholy Jewish people look like. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. The book of Daniel is not really just a prophetic book. We put it with the prophets, but it has so much wisdom aspect to it. That if you fear God, you will actually be a wise person. You will bring wisdom to the world. I actually think that this is just an eternal principle. That God's wisdom comes through people who follow him to bless the world. That you should expect wherever you are, in whatever workplace, home environment, club, whatever it is, you can actually expect, as a follower of Jesus, to bring wisdom for that workplace. Not just in your area of expertise, but you will bring wisdom from God who understands the beginning and the end. Zephaniah chapter 3, we're going to look at Zephaniah later on in the year, talks about what it looks like to be an unholy person, rebellious, defiled, not obeyed God's voice, not received his correction or instruction, not trusted in the Lord. But here is Daniel, who is not defiled and who has received instruction, who lives this life of wisdom. And he's not the only one. This principle that I mentioned is played out throughout the Old Testament, where you have people who have been holy to God come into an unholy kingdom and brought blessing and wisdom, not just for themselves, but for that whole nation. So Joseph and his Technicolor dream coat, and he goes to Egypt, and it's a terrible road to get there. But in the end, he actually brings great blessing through his wisdom as a person of the God of Israel, and he brings relief from famine to the whole of that nation. Nehemiah, he is the cupbearer to the king. And then he has the king's favor, and the king allows him, and they head back and they rebuild in Jerusalem. Esther brings her own skills, yes, beauty, but also wisdom to save God's people because of her place in the king's court. This actually happens time and time again, and it's what God does. So here we have God's wisdom through God's obedient people bringing blessing to Nebuchadnezzar. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. I want to close with this. God's good kingdom is always invading the kingdoms of evil, but it may not look like you expect. If you're anything like me, you think, well, if I serve a good God, then anything that pops up against me, God should be whack-a-moling it. And he's like, you know, I mean, he's going to be really good at it, like really, really fast. He knows where it's going to come up. So it's just like, it's going to be amazing. In the book of Daniel, we're thinking, well, come on. Okay, Assyria's there. Okay, whack Assyria, whack Egypt, now Babylon. You're supposed to whack Babylon, then whack the Medes and the Persians, and then would you whack the Greeks? And then it's not how he does it. Instead of this, he somehow brings his wisdom, goodness, grace, and blessing into the kingdom itself through this suffering, through this humiliation, through this terrible exile, right into the belly of the beast goes God in his people. And then he brings his kingdom. Someone else followed that pattern. We think, well, God could have whacked anything that came against people, himself, his son. The last enemy, the great kingdom of sin and death, couldn't he just whack it? But instead, Jesus goes into the belly of the beast. He goes right into, through humiliation, through pain, through suffering and death, into the kingdom of darkness. And he explodes it from the inside out. When you find yourself in darkness, don't think God hasn't whacked this. Where is God? You know this is what God does. This is what God does. He brings a person in and explodes it from the inside out. So as we go through the book of Daniel, remember Jesus. Remember Daniel. And know that God's kingdom always wins from the inside out. Let's pray. Lord God, we want to be a people who live in an unholy kingdom, but with holiness. Lord, you know. You know where we need to be distinctive. You know where we need to be obedient. You know where we need to choose that thing that we can control. to show our loyalty to you, our integrity, our mourning over sin, and our expectation that you will do something good. Lord, speak to us in all our spheres of life about how we might be used by you to explode the unholy kingdoms from the inside out as you bring your holiness in us. Amen.